Well, you know, not very well, actually. I have things I can say about it, and I have a section in the book about it. But, you know, well, first thing to say is every view in Christian theology has problem texts. Okay? And I'm talking stuff that's in the creeds, too. So stuff that as Christians we have to believe, and yet there's bits of the Bible you think, what? How does that fit? You know? And so similarly, my view has problem text. I would say that's a problem text. And so too is the bit about the devil in the lake of fire. So that was my weakest bit in my Revelation chapter. I don't know, trust you to go for it. But I deserve that. Absolutely. I mean, you know, I'm responsible for writing what I said. And I was suitably tentative about that. But I was aware that it's a bit, there's more of a problem text than something. So there are problem texts. And so the first thing I would say is, you know, what is an appropriate reaction when you come across a problem text? And I think that, of course, you have to be honest about it and say, and so on. But it doesn't immediately make me think, gosh, I must be wrong or something, okay? Because otherwise I wouldn't believe anything as a Christian at all, because pretty much anything I could think of, there's texts I can't understand how they fit with that. And I don't tend to think, gosh, I must be wrong. I tend to think, okay, I'll put it on the shelf and and it's only one that, and Thomas Kuhn in his Structures of Scientific Revolution, you know, talks about this, how you have paradigms and science and so on, and there's only when anomalies build up that can't be explained that the tension builds up, and then when you've got some model that explains more data better, you get it, and so on. But scientists, when they first of all get these anomalies that don't fit, the first thing they try and do is sort of tweak the model and get them in and, you know, put epicycles in. Right? So that, I think, is a perfectly appropriate thing to try and do if you don't understand a text. So the first thing is, I'm not satisfied with anything I have to say about that text. I can say a few things about it. First of all, it's somewhat, seems to me to be somewhat anomalous in terms of Jesus' teaching, in that I'm not aware of anywhere else in Jesus' teaching where, you know, the punishment is always future. You know, when Jesus is talking about punishment, it's going to come, and yet in this story, the guy dies and he goes straight to this. Now that's, at least as far as I'm aware, there's nothing else in Jesus' talk of coming judgment that's like that. So that immediately makes me think, oh, what's going on here? Of course, also, Jesus is talking about Hades. Is this the same thing as Gehenna? Well, you know, and that probably depends what you think going on in the Gehenna stuff as well, and whether Tom Wright and all that is right. I kind of like to think he might be, but I assume he's not, just to make it harder for myself. So is it the same thing? Is Jesus actually talking about hell at all, or is Hades really Sheol? I mean, so is this some conception of an intermediate state with different compartments? And the problem is, Second Temple Jewish literature, as I understand it, and I'm no expert on it, but what I've read on it, it seems to have such an array of complicated, different views on what happens when you die and judgment and whether there's annihilation or eternal suffering, as Judith seems to imply. Or even whether it's possible to be saved from Gehenna, as some texts seem to suggest, some rabbinic texts. It's such a mess, you know, so what exactly is the background that we should be reading Jesus against here? Also, of course, Jesus is primarily interested in the parable about riches, and he's not really trying to teach about the afterlife. And so I guess I'm a little bit cagey as to I'm just not sure how much we can extrapolate what Jesus thought or was teaching about or affirming about eschatological punishment from the parable, because he's not primarily interested in that, and it's even possible that he's, and various people have suggested, that he's actually using a sort of common folk tale, which he's not necessarily affirming, but some of his old listeners would have been into it, and he's twisting it against them and so on, and that might be the case. You know, that might be the case. I don't know. I mean, of course, you could also do, there was an 18th century Baptist universalist called Elhanan Winchester, and he had a very interesting theological take on this. He did think it was about hell, and he said, no one can bridge this chasm, you see, except for Christ. See, so now, I'm not saying Luke is using the parable like this, so this is his sort of theological, so he uses a descent into hell thing, and he says Christ is the only one, no human can bridge the gap. Christ, the gap is bridged in Christ, you see, when he descends into hell, and says, well, interesting. I mean, it's a creative theological move rather than an exegesis of Luke. But it is interesting. You know, I have some sympathy with that. You'd have to read my section in the book, and then you'd have to go and write the proper thing that should be said, because I'm not happy with what I wrote about that. Knut.